The headlines. The British ruling party figures warned that Prime Minister Boris Johnson could be gone within a year amid a series of scandals involving him and his aides. New data shows that COVID hospitalizations across the U.S. have jumped 45% over the last month amid the spread of the Omicron variant. And the death toll from a super typhoon sweeping through the Philippines rises to 33, with dozens more missing. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been in hot water in recent weeks amid a series of scandals leading to a decline in public support for him. Johnson is now facing a waning support from within his own Conservative Party as senior members demand a government shakeup. The members say that Johnson is on notice and he could be gone within a year unless he cleans up his act. Just on Thursday, UK Conservatives lost their parliamentary seat in North Shropshire after almost 200 years. That happened amid controversies over a number of issues, including parties held at Downing Street during COVID lockdowns last year. Johnson apologized and his advisor resigned to ease public anger, but to no avail. Things got uglier after reports emerged of two other lockdown parties held last year at the office of the senior civil servant probing the previous gatherings. The official has not quit the investigation. December 18 marks International Migrants Day. The occasion highlights the misery and hardships that migrants encounter as they leave their home in hopes of finding a better place to live. The following report takes a closer look at the main reasons behind migration that has turned into a serious global challenge.
Migration, an ongoing phenomenon, seems to be endless. Countries around the world have always had to deal with migrants coming from various destinations. A broad range of factors contribute to the movement of people, including economic challenges, extreme poverty, or conflict. According to the United Nations, around 281 million people were international migrants in 2020. That represents 3.6% of the global population. In recent years, the wave of migration has taken a different turn as Europe and the United States have become the main destinations for migrants. Large numbers of people have tried to reach Europe from countries in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, both witnessing wars in which the U.S. and some Western states have played a big role. The U.S. itself has faced a growing number of asylum seekers trying to reach there from Central American countries. The root causes for that include economic crises blamed on U.S. policies towards these countries. Migration has also become a source of political tensions among countries, with the latest examples in Europe. Belarus and neighboring Poland are at odds over the situation of thousands of migrants stranded at the border. The UK and France have also locked horns over the rising number of migrants trying to cross the English Channel into Britain. All this comes as many migrants lose their lives through their perilous journey.
As the migrants were drowning, the British government should have at least saved them and deported them to France. No problem, but at least they would have been alive.
If they make it, they will have to spend the rest of their days in squalid conditions in border camps. And even if they manage to get into the country of their dreams, things won't be better either. Discrimination, hunger, and misery is all they will find. Issues that contribute to the reason drawing widespread criticism against Europe and the US over their migration policies. There have been other destinations for migrants too. Iran is one of them. It hosts Afghans fleeing poverty and conflict triggered by two decades of the U.S.-led military presence in Afghanistan that came to an end just this past August. Several millions of Afghans currently live in Iran, which, according to the UN, make one of the largest refugee populations. The world body has on various occasions hailed Iran for accepting the Afghan refugees. All in all, experts believe the global migration crisis can only be tackled through a concerted effort by countries and enough determination to end conflicts across the world.
The United States is facing a tidal wave of the COVID pandemic driven by the Omicron variant. Experts are warning that the highly contagious strain could worsen an already dangerous surge in cases. Data show COVID hospitalizations have jumped 45% in the U.S. over the last month. Daily cases have also increased by 40%, reaching a seven-day average of 124,000. New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Michigan are the hardest hit. The outbreaks have postponed or canceled sports events and popular shows. Public health officials say Omicron is likely to become the dominant variant in the U.S. Top infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci also warns that Omicron's infectiousness could cause many additional deaths. Over 800,000 Americans have already died from the COVID. Authorities are reinstating a workplace vaccine rule covering 80 million workers nationwide to curb the outbreaks. Meanwhile, Australia reports record-high new COVID-19 cases for a third consecutive day, especially in its two most populous states. Officials in New South Wales and Victoria together register over 4,000 infections in the past 24 hours. That's higher than case numbers recorded one day earlier. However, Prime Minister Scott Morrison continues to downplay the risks at his government as his government eases pandemic curbs. Morrison argues that the focus should be on hospitalization and cases in ICUs rather than actual tallies. In the latest easing of the curbs, fully vaccinated international travelers will no longer be isolated in Sydney and Melbourne. Australia shut down its borders soon after the virus outbreak there in early 2020. That kept its cases down relative to other rich nations. The country has so far recorded about 239,000 infections and over 2,100 related deaths. Omicron is raising concerns in Europe, with several countries struggling to cope with record daily infections caused by the newly identified variant. France's up to 10% of its new cases are suspected to be Omicron. The health minister says the new variant is the main reason for the planned introduction of a new vaccination pass early next year. On Friday, Britain registered over 93,000 new daily cases. That was a record number. Out of that, 3,200 were Omicron cases, up from nearly 1,700 reported on Thursday. Meanwhile, Germany logged nearly 43,000 new infections and over 400 deaths in the past 24 hours. On Friday, the country designated France and Denmark as high-risk zones. Berlin says that it will impose quarantine on unvaccinated travelers from the two states. The Omicron variant of the coronavirus has caused fresh concerns in India, leaving health experts pondering if the vaccines are effective against the variant. As Munawwar Zaman reports, cases have subdued over the last few months, but the pandemic has left a collateral damage of immeasurable extent. Here's more from New Delhi.
The new variant of the COVID-19 pandemic has caused fresh worries in the world's second most populous nation. The Indian subcontinent, which encountered deadly episode of the early pandemic, is now gearing up for yet another phase. The country is on high alert, with many health experts fearing if the country is ready to face a new challenge. Based on the World Health Organization, the variant is spreading at the fastest pace compared with earlier ones.
This is a scientific knowledge, but our approach broadly is to do full-blown genomic sequencing in a systematic way from international travelers and also from the cases of COVID that we are now detecting.
Based on health ministry data, 55% of the eligible population has been fully vaccinated, while 87% have received the first dose. Now, in the wake of rapid spread of the super variant Omicron, the country is gearing up for worst scenario. Health experts say there is a chance current vaccines becoming ineffective in emerging situations. India's Omicron case tally stood at 73 on Thursday, with New Delhi, Rajasthan, Maharashtra, Tamil Nadu, Telangana and West Bengal reporting new variants.
Nothing to panic. We must stay calm. We must stay indoor. We must follow the COVID guidelines. People are careless. People are not wearing masks. They are making overcrowding. And that's why this corona is spreading like a fire.
India reported its lowest number of active COVID-19 cases in 18 months on Thursday. Based on government data, the total number of COVID infection in the country stands at 87,000, lowest since March. India's overall COVID-19 caseload has surged to 34 million. Many fear the reoccurrence of April, when the country was ravaged by severe healthcare crisis with people battling for oxygen. The subcontinent is still recovering from the collateral damage of immeasurable extent, such as rising poverty, unemployment and migrant crisis, besides economic slowdown. With this new variant picking up pace rapidly, health authorities have been urging people to abide by basic COVID guidelines to avoid a similar situation that collapsed the country's healthcare during the second wave. Now, fears are also growing of another economic slowdown and fresh travel restrictions. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
A super typhoon sweeping through the Philippines leaves a trail of death and destruction. At least 33 people are now confirmed dead in the strongest storm to hit the Archipelago this year. Typhoon Rhea has ravaged southern and central regions of the Philippines, forcing more than 300,000 people to flee their homes. Packing winds of 195 kilometers per hour, the storm has ripped off roofs, toppled power poles, and uprooted trees. People are now without communications and electricity in many areas. Floods caused by torrential rain have hit villages also. Officials say reports of devastation are alarming on the islands that have taken the brunt of the storm. Over 18,000 military, police, Coast Guard, and fire personnel are joining search and rescue efforts in the worst affected regions. South Korea has pressed forward for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. The United States has largely foiled the initiative, however, issuing fresh sanctions on North Korea. South Korea's unification minister remains optimistic that there can be some new, more peaceful arrangements for the region as South Korean President Moon Jae-in nears the end of his term. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
South Korea this week continued efforts for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. President Moon Jae-in sought Australia's support for the peace-building effort, while his unification minister in Seoul told a forum that the time had come to replace the armistice with a permanent peace.
Never in the 68-year history of the ceasefire have the concerned countries gathered and such discussion materialized for an end of the Korean War. But if we just let this opportunity pass, we cannot imagine how much time will be wasted before a complete end of war on the Korean Peninsula, where strategic interests intersect so fiercely.
The United States, however, Friday issued further sanctions against North Korean officials and organizations, dampening South Korea's attempts at engagement. North Korea sees hypocrisy in U.S. criticism of its military and U.S.-led sanctions. Still, some analysts believe Pyongyang is open to negotiations.
North Korea's request for the elimination of double standards and an end to the hostile policy toward it indicates that if South Korea and the United States show sincerity, then they will willingly discuss the issues with South Korea and the U.S.
Analysts have also suggested the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics may offer a chance to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for some type of contact, but the U.S. has announced its diplomats will boycott the Games. An official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War may offer South Korean President Moon Jae-in some tangible result for the peacekeeping efforts he's made throughout his term. But next year we'll see a new president elected here in South Korea and perhaps far different policies in terms of inter-Korean relations. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The war in Afghanistan came to an end months ago, but its legacy will probably haunt the U.S. for a very long time, as it was America's longest war. Many Americans are wondering how their country got involved in a military mission which has been described as a complete fiasco.
Months after a chaotic end to its disastrous war in Afghanistan, failure of America's longest military mission is fueling a heated debate about U.S. militarism. The war dragged on for two decades and cost American taxpayers over $2.3 trillion. Thousands of American troops lost their lives, and many more were injured in the protracted military campaign that's been widely described as a fiasco. The war wreaked havoc on Afghanistan, with tens of thousands of civilians losing their lives or limbs. On August the 30th, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan after a terrible loss to the enemy it invaded Afghanistan to defeat. There is absolutely no doubt that the Afghan mission ended in failure. Afghanistan was the first country attacked by America as part of its so-called War on Terror, launched by former President George W. Bush. Almost none of the stated goals of the Afghan mission were ever fulfilled. In late September, America's highest-ranking general, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, said during a Senate hearing that the U.S. pullout with the Taliban back in power is quote-unquote a strategic failure.
America's weakness has been exposed to the world. I mean, essentially, America's incompetence, its military weakness, its lack of foresight, was exposed as a result of the chaotic pullout of Afghanistan. America, it was shown that America had no idea why it was there. It had no clear goals. It lacked the military means for subduing the Taliban. And all it could do was spread destruction. So that is essentially exposes the incredible weakness of the American empire.
Many Americans are still looking for answers. What brought their country to this part of the world? And what kept it fighting a futile war for two decades? Meanwhile, the U.S. is definitely not taking responsibility for the mess that it left behind in this volatile region as huge waves of Afghan refugees overwhelm neighboring countries and beyond.
The 20-year Afghan mission, which involved four American administrations, was replete with failures. U.S. Congress now says it wants to get to the bottom of the fiasco. It is setting up a commission to assess the failures of the war.
The United States has fought many wars during its history. Over the past decades, most U.S. military missions have been criticized for not going as planned. The Afghan mission became particularly notorious for lack of strategy and proper planning. U.S. lawmakers have launched a commission to study the Afghanistan fiasco. This week, the U.S. Congress voted to set up a commission to assess the failures during the 20-year war. The commission was part of an annual military package passed by the Senate on Wednesday after approval last week by the House of Representatives. The bipartisan commission on Afghanistan will have 16 members. It faces a deadline to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting, and a final report within 3 years. The legislation said, quote, "The commission shall conduct a comprehensive assessment of the war in Afghanistan and make recommendations to inform future operations with tactical and strategic lessons learned, including the impact of troop increases and decreases, and date certain deadlines." The congressional panel will also study George W. Bush's launch of the war, as well as American policy on Afghanistan in the years before the mission.
We can be rest assured it will be unperceptive, unanalytical, and unintelligent. That seems to be quite clear. The U.S. is incapable of learning. It's incapable of learning from its past mistakes. It's destined to keep on making the same mistakes over and over again.
The United States seems to be reflecting on its longest war months after the chaotic pullout. Will it learn from its long list of failures in Afghanistan?
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Elam commemoration ceremony.
On February 12, 1987, two young teams from Elam played in a soccer match in commemoration of the seventh victory of the revolution. The people had gathered there as well as spectators, but an Iraqi plane struck them from up close. It is necessary for these events to be made known to people on a global level. They should be repeatedly mentioned here and there, because this is the message of the innocence of our athletic martyrs, whose only crime was that they had organized a soccer match for the Islamic Republic. With the support of which power did the malicious Saddam commit that appalling, brazen crime? Who was behind him? The same people who used to support the bloodthirsty wolf on that day are claiming to be advocates of human rights today. They describe themselves as the guardians of human rights throughout the world. There is so much brazenness and shamelessness in the actions of these powers. Who should reveal their true colors? Who should reveal these truths? Our artists and our writers have a heavy load on their shoulders. They have a heavy duty. These things should be presented to the world using art as the medium. They should make films about these events. In the case of the massacre at the soccer match, they should write stories, make films, and compose memoirs. These actions should be taken.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of the unique characteristics of the province of Elam is that there are families with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 10 martyrs. As pointed out by the gentleman, there is one family with 10 martyrs, another with 9, another with 8, and some with 5 or 6 martyrs. This is only easy in words, but it is truly difficult to even think about it. Elam is like this. There are such families in Elam. It was mentioned that some members of these families are present in this commemoration ceremony. I hope that God will bestow His mercy and grace on all of you. Another characteristic of Elam was the wholehearted presence of people from all social backgrounds, from scholars to the common people. For instance, the late Sheikh Abdul Rahman Haydari, may God's mercy be upon him, was with me on the Maymak Hills. He was with me at the top of that summit. He was with me everywhere I went.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost.
Africa Today.
The people of Morocco have been holding protests to condemn, in their strongest possible terms, their country's recent move to sign a military cooperation agreement with the Israeli regime. Now, this pact comes after a normalization deal between the two sides that continue to be condemned. Moroccans have held massive rallies to reject their government's move.
Today we are here as much as with all Moroccans, human rights organizations, political unions that support the Palestinian people, that denounce the war crimes of the Zionist occupation against the Palestinian people. We are also against the normalization of relations of the Moroccan state with Zionism.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on increasing demonstrations by the people of Morocco who oppose their government's move to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Moroccans consider such a move as betrayal to the Palestinian cause. In the second part of our program, we shall discuss plans to develop a battery minerals industry in the Democratic Republic of Congo. If this plan materializes, it is expected to open a new era that will transform the country's economy. Stay tuned as our experts give us incisive analysis on these two issues.
Moroccans reject normalization with Israel. Anger and resentment is increasing in Morocco against the country's move to normalize ties with the brutal Israeli regime, which continues to commit atrocities against Palestinians while occupying the territories. Recently, demonstrators took to the streets in several cities across Morocco to protest Rabat's normalization of ties with the Israeli regime and the recent military agreements signed between the two sides.
The demonstrators chanted anti-Israeli regime slogans calling for an end to normalization of relations between Rabat and Tel Aviv and expressing their full and unflinching support for the liberation of Palestine. Now, for an insight on Moroccans' rejection of normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, my colleague contacted Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Now, we first asked Mr. Hamdi if the rulers of Morocco are listening to the people who are visibly angry at the kingdom's move to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
The Moroccan government did not normalize ties with Israel in a vacuum, but rather suggested that its normalization of ties with Israel was in exchange for the U.S. recognizing Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara, in that the Moroccan government sought to add some sort of nuance to the debate, in that the normalization of ties was not necessarily done out of any regard for Israel, but rather as part of this wider strategy of asserting Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara. And this is what perhaps divided Moroccan public opinion and prevented the Moroccans from adopting a unified stance in terms of being against normalization of ties.
Now, as Mr. Hamdi mentioned there, Morocco's decision to normalize ties with the Israeli regime came after former U.S. President Donald Trump recognized the North African country's sovereignty over Western Sahara, which has been at the center of a decades-old territorial dispute between Morocco and the Polisario Front. Now, Mouloud Said, a representative of the Polisario Front in Washington, says the recognition will not change the facts about Western Sahara.
But this decision is not going to change the fact that the Sahrawi Republic is a full member of the African Union, that Morocco occupies part of this territory, and it's not going to change the nature of the conflict. This decision, it was done without advancing any legal argument, because they will not find it anywhere. And Western Sahara is not just a piece of real estate that President Trump can give. It's a territory that belongs to its people and a full-fledged member of a continental organization.
Morocco annexed the vast Western Sahara region, a former Spanish colony, in the 1970s, and has since been in conflict with the Polisario Front, a movement that seeks to establish an independent state in the territory and end Morocco's presence there. The people of Morocco insist that the issue of Western Sahara should not be linked to support for Palestinian liberation, and they have therefore rejected normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Despite attempts by the regime in Morocco to ban the protests, people turned out in masses to support Palestine and reject normalization with the Israeli regime. Why is the Kingdom of Morocco going against popular demands and insisting on normalization of ties with the Israeli regime?
I think that this is rather another series in the latest chapter, or another chapter in this series of relations between Morocco and Israel, and that Morocco, which has become increasingly frustrated over the issue of the Western Sahara, as it sees a lack of progress towards recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara, Morocco believes that given now there's this wave of normalization with Israel on the basis that Israel will provide guarantees of access to the White House or favorable influence in the White House, Morocco believes that if the UAE is benefiting from that, if Qatar has benefited from that in the past, if Mohammed bin Salman has been benefiting from that, then Morocco also can benefit from that.
In November, Israeli regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, and Moroccan Defense Minister Abdellatif Loldigi signed a military and espionage cooperation agreement in Rabat. Now, this agreement attracted widespread condemnation inside Morocco.
We came to protest against the visit of the war criminal, the Zionist minister to Morocco. We don't accept this. And we consider it a mistake and a betrayal. He is a war criminal who should be prosecuted, and his place is not in our country.
Now, what are the implications of the military pact between the Israeli regime and Morocco, especially for neighboring Algeria and the entire Maghreb region?
I think when it comes to the implications for Algeria or for the neighboring countries, I think the implications are quite grave, and that's why Algiers has been particularly upset over normalization of ties with Morocco, and why after the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid criticized Algeria from Rabat, from Morocco, Algeria decided to suspend diplomatic ties with Morocco and then close its airspace to Moroccan planes, because the reality is that there are a number of issues in the region in which the Americans are heavily involved in that matter to Algeria, whether that's with regards to Mali, whether that's with regards to the civil war in Libya. And the belief is that with Morocco's ties with Israel, Israel will levy those ties or use its influence in the White House against Algeria's interests in the region, as it seeks to appease Morocco in order to encourage Morocco to really expand on these ties, to really expand the normalization and not reverse course. In other words, even if normalization was built on originally on an exchange of interest, Israel is very keen to ensure that these relations improve into something different, and therefore it may well be that Israel will seek to deliver on that by bringing the U.S. influence to bear on Algeria in Morocco's favor.
The normalization deal between Morocco and Israel in December triggered fresh tensions between Rabat and Algiers. The president of Algeria denounced the normalization deals and categorically stated that his country will continue supporting Palestine.
Now, we finally asked Mr. Sami Hamdi his opinion on the claim by Moroccan authorities that normalization of ties with the Israeli regime aims to serve the kingdom's interests while claiming that they still support the Palestinian people.
It's clear in the region, with regards to the regimes at least, that Palestine is no longer a priority. We saw Gulf media in Saudi Arabia and in the UAE almost repeating Israeli narratives on the Palestinian issue, criticizing Hamas and criticizing Palestinian factions for the military escalation that took place during the Gaza war. In other words, Palestine is no longer this unifying issue with regards to the regime. So for Morocco argues that, you know, it cannot be more royal than royalty. In other words, that they will not take the lead on the Palestinian issue. The way the tides in the region are shifting, their priority is the Western Sahara. Normalization of ties with Israel helps to bring about U.S. recognition of Moroccan sovereignty of the Western Sahara. That's what matters, not the Palestinian issue. And I think that's the reality of what is unfolding.
Well, there you have it. The Kingdom of Morocco has betrayed Palestinians in favor of ties with the brutal Israeli regime occupying Palestinian territories. But the people of Morocco have clearly chosen to side with the oppressed Palestinians. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about how the Democratic Republic of Congo plans to develop a regional industry of electric battery minerals. Stay with us. The Democratic Republic of Congo Africa Business Forum 2021 was held last November. Now, the theme of the forum was economic integration of the Congolese in the value chain of the electric battery industry through innovative financial solutions.
During the events in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, a series of firm commitments were signed for the development of a battery mineral industry in the Democratic Republic of Congo. To put words into action, stakeholders agreed to create a battery council in the DRC in order to set up a special financial vehicle to facilitate private investments and the participation of the population.
The United Nations Economic Commission for Africa was one of the stakeholders at the forum. Now, the Commission's Executive Secretary speaks here on the Kinshasa Forum.
As the world becomes increasingly conscious of the need to pursue net zero carbon emissions against the specter of global climate disaster, a movement for green productivity and consumption is gaining traction. That's why a global battery electric vehicle industry is growing at a fast pace and is projected to be worth $8.8 trillion by 2025. Africa is in a good position to profit from this global movement towards decarbonization, as it is home to key battery minerals such as cobalt, copper, lithium, and manganese. The DRC is a case in point. It currently supplies 70% of the world's cobalt use in electric vehicle manufacture, but captures no more than 3% of the battery electric vehicle mining value chain. But how much transformation will happen to DRC and other African countries currently engaged in producing and selling raw materials will only depend on how fast they move up.
Well, now for more on the economic integration of the DRC in the value chain of the electric battery industry, we contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist and a trade policy analyst at Southern and Eastern Africa Trade Information and Negotiations Institute, Uganda. Now, we first asked Mr. Kiiza if he finally sees light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the DRC adding value to its minerals and thus realizing the dream of its heroic independence hero, Patrice Lumumba.
Since independence of Africa, industrialization through mineral beneficiation has been high on the continent's agenda and on African countries' national development agendas. However, this has over time been hampered and constrained by the continuous primary commodity dependence, where Africa has been locked into supply of raw materials to its former colonial masters. But the current move by, for example, DRC to add value on its minerals reflects the new agenda of Africa be able to, and the new resolve by Africa be able to become self-sustaining through mineral beneficiation, through adding value on its products. So yes, it is a good move and it reflects a new independent Africa.
In a speech at the Economic Forum, DRC President Felix Tshisekedi said that with its cobalt and other battery minerals, the country must play a frontline role in greening the world's economy. He also invited other African countries to participate in the electric battery industry projects.
I would like to invite my African counterparts to seize the opportunity to build the battery industry together. The market for electric vehicles is projected to represent $8 trillion by 2025 and $46 trillion by 2050.
The president of the DRC also expressed a strong political commitment to the project by stating the machine is now launched, it's necessary to start right after this forum. What else is needed to make this project a success apart from the political will by the government?
The question of finance, of course, apart from political will, is very critical. Quite often we have seen Africa's agenda, government agenda, Africa's industrial initiatives being financed by other powers like the EU, like the US, Canada. And to me, I think this already robs Africa of policy space, of sovereignty, but also on determining the pace of implementation of such agendas. And that's why you find that, for example, technical advisors, experts, engineers, and all that often come from the, you know, the development partners. And so it is important that apart from political will, resources and financing capacities are generated within Africa, within the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Now, according to experts, the Democratic Republic of Congo can leverage its abundant cobalt resources and hydroelectric power to become a low-cost and low-emissions producer of electric batteries. A participant of the DRC Africa Business Forum 2021 elaborates here.
The United States, you take Poland, and you take China, as well as the DRC. If you wanted to build a precursor plant today, you are looking at a scenario where the DRC will be the cheapest place to build it. It would only cost $39 million to build a 10,000 metric tons capacity plant. If you are going to build this in the United States, you are looking at $120 million.
Now, if the DRC electric battery industry is a success, then clearly this initiative will rewrite the narrative of Africa, and its economic effects will spread throughout the continent. Now, are we seeing a new Africa emerging? This is a question we pose to Mr. Kiza.
To avoid being pessimistic, indeed, if I can show a bit of optimism, if the electric battery project is a success, it will be one of the examples to show that yes, can be done. But again, to me, the question is, what kind of success do we envision project to be? Is it the success that is engineered, that is shared by Africans, by the citizens of the DRC? Or if it's the success that is being championed by China, by EU, by North America, by Canada, then this is not the kind of success we want. But yes, the narrative of Africa rising, Africa reimagining for the better, has been high on the agenda, and indeed it has gained currency.
At the meeting, Bosch, a German multinational, made a commitment to work with African actors engaged in the development of this electric battery industry in the DRC. There is deep concern that the people of Congo might not get the benefits they deserve from this project. Mr. Kiza says there are no conclusive safeguards in place to ensure that the Congolese own the upcoming electric battery industry project.
The question of really ownership of such projects by Africans, I always grow cold feet when I see a foreign international claiming to support Africa in implementing its own development initiatives. And to me, I think development financing should be from within. For Africa, for this project to be able to materialize, there should be as less contact, as less financing, as less support by the third parties as possible.
The president of Zambia also attended the Kinshasa forum and said he is offended by the fact that 8 of the 15 mineral producing countries in the world are African, while the value added is in industrialized countries.
I think those countries that are producing the electric cars,
les véhicules électriques,
must see the opportunity we the Africans see. And obviously, it is easy to find common ground. And common ground is there. Working together,
travail ensemble,
technology, as I said, finance,
the finance,
resource holders, ourselves, we would achieve this balance for mutual benefit.
We asked Mr. Kiza if the industrialized countries, especially in the West, will agree to easily lose their monopoly in the electric battery industry. Now, there is also concern that they might put impediments to the DRC's project.
We can take an example of, for example, oil, and how there have been coups, there have been assassinations, there have been toppling of governments, facilitated and financed by the United States, by the way. Is on the record. Confessions and economic equipment, then Perkins talks about this, especially because when such countries start to control their oil and natural resources, the USA does not allow that. So I don't see this project taking shape because there are many vested interests by the third parties, by the already industrialized countries. Because you can look at an example. The EU has what they call a raw material initiative, which looks at increasing access to raw materials. Now, I don't see a situation where the EU, for example, where Belgium, where the UK, where Germany will allow for their countries, for their industries to be starved of raw materials and allow the ERC electric battery project to thrive.
The United States recently dispatched special forces to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and this has raised doubts if the DRC can independently add value to its minerals without interference from the United States and others. Now, Mr. Kiza believes that the U.S. plays a destabilizing role wherever it goes, and so the DRC is no exception.
The United States has often been known to play a destabilizing role and function in mineral-rich countries, be it Sierra Leone, be it Liberia, be it DRC, be it other, name any other country, be it Angola. The United States has often been a bad actor to ensure that there are prolonged insurgencies, there are prolonged wars. I don't see the entry and the involvement of the United States in the Congo as a big as something that we should celebrate as Africans, as the Democratic Republic of Congo, because again, it is most important that there is as little interference as possible from the third parties when it comes to implementation of this project. Self-determination is something that the Democratic Republic of the Congo requires now in order to be able to implement this project.
Well, there you have it. The Democratic Republic of Congo will only succeed in adding value to its minerals if the country is truly independent and devoid of foreign interference. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you. Goodbye for now, and God bless you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you're listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to be here.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So today we want to talk about Lady Fatima al-Zahra, you know, and regarding her as a role model for all the women in the world, you know. In her very short lifespan, Lady Fatima al-Zahra had direct impact on the community of Islam on her time and after that. This was not only because she was the daughter of Prophet Muhammad. This was because she had her own independent lifestyle, which was really fruitful, both inside the house and outside the house. These are all authentic according to the historical accounts, according to the events and the records that and the documents that exist during the history of Islam. Maybe it's Muslims and even maybe some of the non-Muslims are not familiar with the conduct, the seerah, and the lifestyle of Lady Fatima al-Zahra. Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about her life account.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about the Lady Fatima salamullah alayha, we should bear in mind that we are talking about a lady who is the master of all the women in the world. And like Sayyidatul Nisa'il Alameen, that's her title.
Okay.
And she's the daughter of the Prophet, and she's the master of all the women in the heaven. And when we're talking about such a personality, it is very important to look deeply in her life, that what she should use to do and how she became or how she got such a rank. Is it just because being the daughter of the Prophet or no? There was a practical aspect, yes, in her life and her own struggles due to which she got such a rank. Definitely, obviously, it's because of her own personality that she had. We can see her in different aspects of the life. For example, when she's a daughter, how she served her father and mother, obviously. And when she got married, how she was as a wife for a husband. And when she became mother, what kind of mother she was. So this is the personal aspect of the life. But on the other hand, we can see that she had a big role in the society as well. For example, helping the people outside. Yes. And even in the battles, she was also involved, like helping and bringing water, you know, giving first aid to the, yes, to those who got injured. So we can see her being active in the social, personal, and in all aspects of the life.
That's
so
right.
This is what basically a woman means in the Islamic context.
Context, that's
it's
right.
Not just a woman sitting in home and doing nothing and just, yes, raising kids.
Yes. What you said is really controversial, because so many of the critics of the religion of Islam believe that Islam believes in the role of the women as something which is inside the house, you know, a person who is inside the house, just cooking and taking care of the husband and the children. But in the life account of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, we could find a way around, I mean, being active in the society too, okay? But with its own standards and criteria, and this is really important, I mean, because Lady Fatima al-Zahra was famous for her chastity, you know, this iffah and the haya that she had in the society, with the people around, with the strangers, but at the same time, a strong personality, although she did not live long, I mean, about maybe 18 or 20 years old, according to some accounts, and, you know, we have her martyrdom anniversary in the month of Jamadi al-Awwal and Jamadi al-Sani, you know, according to the lunar calendar. Say, Murza, talk a little bit about this aspect of the life of Lady Fatima al-Zahra for us.
Well, in my personal point of view, and this comes from studies that I had in the past, for a person becoming a role model for a large number of people, I can call it the whole communities. Some features are really important, and you know, Lady Fatima inherited some of these great features from her father. I mean, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. When we talk about wisdom, determinations, patience, you know, courage, and any positive qualities that you can count, they are all in her life and in her personality.
That's right.
So someone who has such a great personality can certainly have a great influence and effect directly on people around her.
Okay.
And if you look at her two different lives, private life and social life, you can see these features have, you know, have been pictured, have been drawn as a very nice, you know, a drawing that people can learn a lesson from. So my brother mentioned that she was involved in fightings, in battles. She was not actually picking up the sword and fighting. She was just providing some kind of help,
yes.
You know, the first aid care and any other types of help. So it shows that her knowledge, her determination, and all these qualities was making her as a role model. And you know, no one can become actually a role model without some good qualities.
Yes.
This is what we have to accept in the first place.
Okay.
Unfortunately, these days, we don't have a person who has all these qualities together.
Okay.
So, you know, some of these qualities that she inherited from her father,
yes.
It shows that something was actually given to her by Allah the Almighty.
Yes.
So this gives a picture to us that a role model that we believe for all humanity,
okay.
specifically talking for women, is Lady Fatima, because she has,
right.
You know, connection with the heaven and with God,
that's
but
right.
with you know, Allah the Almighty.
Okay. And Sayyid Mohsen, is it true that Lady Fatima was the true reviver of the original